The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of February 20th, 2018. On this week's show, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of Olympic stuff, the United States' lousy medal count, the return of the shirtless Tongan American hero Michaela Schifrin, and the rise of the quad jump in figure skating. Will we get to all of that? I would listen to the show if I were you to find out. For the final segment of the show, I will also be joined by Kyle Newbeck of Philly Voice, who will discuss the enigma of Markelle Fultz, the Philadelphia 76ers rookie who went number one in the NBA draft and has since disappeared from view. The Shibutani to my Shibutani, Stefan Fatsis, is out this week, but I'm thrilled to be joined again by the Guillaume Cizerone to my Gabriella Papadakis, Justin Peters. He's blogging the Olympics for Slate. Hello, Justin.
Hey, Josh. How's it going?
It's going very well. And with us from Pyeongchang, South Korea, is the Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen, a man who combines the fierceness of Tessa Virtue and the lustrous brown hair of Scott Moir. Hello, Ben.
Hello. I'm glad I'm both because I was going to ask which one I was, and I was going to prefer to be both. So I'm glad that's how I'm introduced.
Here's my first question for you as we begin the show. What is it like to watch ice dancing in person? I know you were there yesterday or today, whatever the hell day it is.
Yeah, I don't know what day it is either. It's not the same as figure skating because, and especially not the same as men's figure skating because you kind of get used to watching the guys do all of these incredible jumps, and the entire rhythm of those programs seems to revolve around waiting for those quads and seeing if they'll land them or not. So when an entire program is sort of bound by gravity to the ice, it's kind of strange, and you kind of get into the music and you're watching their expressions more. I don't know. It's not the same. I think I do prefer figure skating more, but I will admit, I kind of got into the Shibutani's Coldplay thing a little bit today.
Well, I actually wanted to play a clip, not from the Coldplay part of the evening, although Coldplay, always nice for a night of ice dancing. But this is from the Virtue and Moir gold medal winning routine. Let's take a listen to that. Justin, I don't want to call you out at the very top of the show, but when...
No, call away. That's fine.
when that came on TV last night, you wrote to me and asked, did they hire a hobo to sing Roxanne for them?
In my defense, it was very late, and I was half paying attention to ice dancing while I was writing another piece, and this music comes through my computer speakers, you know, in which it sounds like Tom Waits's gravelier drunker uncle is covering a Police song for some reason. And when you told me that it was just from the soundtrack of Moulin Rouge, it made a little bit more sense, but not that much more, because it still wasn't clear why that was a great track to skate to. And I still feel there's a 15% chance they may have actually hired a hobo to cover that song for their soundtrack. And I, you know, more power to them. There should be more hobo representation in the ice dancing music selections.
Ben, do you have any insight that you can offer on the Moulin Rougeification of ice dancing?
Well, there's so much Moulin Rouge in figure skating in general this year that, you know, forget about the Olympics. You could fill an entire U.S. team with skaters who have skated to Moulin Rouge programs this year. So it's sort of taken over the sport. And there are a whole bunch of theories among people in the sport as to why. Some of it is nostalgia. People, you know, grew up listening to this music and now they want to be able to perform to it.
I love the fact that there are different theories. I mean, please go on, but just the idea that people are sitting around debating this in ice dancing salons is like, actually, I believe in theory number 8 about why why Moulin Rouge has taken over the sport.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that a lot of the really young skaters who are skating to the movie, you know, had to see the movie before they actually could skate to the music from the movie, because the movie is actually older than them. The movie is 17 years old at this point, and there are like literally 17-year-old skaters at the Olympics. So my colleague Louise Radnofsky and I asked one of the American skaters what he thought of the movie when he finally saw it, and his review was, to be able to make such a deeply emotional story out of a very shallow premise was amazing.
Wow.
It was quite the review. I will say I would subscribe to like a movie blog if you decided to start one.
Let us talk about the notion that the United States is having a lousy Olympics. Barry Svrluga of the Washington Post wrote that. Rachel Bachman, your Wall Street Journal colleague, Ben, did a piece on it. The U.S. as of Tuesday morning Eastern time has 12 medals. That's sixth in the table behind Norway with 29, Germany with 23, Canada 19, Netherlands 14, and France has 13. Neil Payne of 538 crunched the numbers as they are wont to do there back a few days ago when the U.S. had 9 medals, and based on historical trends about how often the United States wins in particular sports, they would have expected to have 18. And the U.S. had 28, 37, 25, and 34 medals for the last 4 Olympics. Justin, I'm going to start with you. You're not necessarily known for being a guy who loves the numbers. I want to talk to you about the emotions. Does it feel to you like the U.S. is having a lousy Olympics?
There have been certain events where you expected the U.S. to do better that they haven't. And I think it's part of the feeling that the U.S. is doing a bad job is a reaction to that. No one expected Michaela Schifrin to come in fourth in the slalom. It's her best event. No one expected Nathan Chen to have 2 crummy short programs. You know, he is the quad king. In part, it feels to me like the sensation of the U.S.'s relative failure at these Olympics is a function of the most prominent athletes' surprising failure to medal in their favorite events. But, you know, we've also won some medals and there's a lot of time to go. So I'm withholding my sorrow or fury until the final count is in.
What do you think, Ben?
I think part of it is actually just the events that have happened so far. Justin, you mentioned Michaela Schifrin finishing fourth in the slalom being a huge surprise. Here's a thought experiment. What happens if she finishes fourth in the giant slalom first and then wins gold in her second event? I think it sort of changes the way we think about Michaela's Olympics so far, just because the expectations for her were so high coming into the Olympics, and then she wins gold in her first event, and it seems like it's going to set off this mania where she could win 3, maybe even 4 individual golds, especially with her best event, the one that she is dominated. You know, she is the best technical skier on the planet, and she has dominated the slalom race like basically no one else in history over the last 4 years. The last time she finished fourth in a slalom race on the World Cup circuit that she finished was in 2014. So for her to finish fourth in that race was just kind of nuts. But, you know, she wasn't really supposed to medal in the giant slalom. That was like a really impressive result for her, and for her to win gold was great. So I think we got our hopes raised for about 24 hours. And then dashed in the exact minute that Nathan Chen fell to the ice on Friday night. So I think part of it is sort of the way we're seeing it. You know, we see American stars crashing at the exact same time in primetime, and they haven't really recovered from that since then.
That's all well and good, sir. But as I explained, Neil Payne of 538 crunched the numbers. He found that given historical trends, the U.S. had 9 medals and they were expected to get 18 just based on the events that had happened thus far. So I think if you look at the cold, hard agate type of the medal table, then I think your like touchy-feely idea that we should be happy that Michaela Schifrin won gold in the giant slalom is not supported, good sir.
To be clear, it's been a pretty disastrous Olympics for the United States. I mean, in our...
That's what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it has been. And in the journal's, you know, pre-Olympic medal projections, I mean, we go through every sport and we assign a certain percentage to where we think the medals are going to go in that sport. And when we crunch the numbers, we had Norway and the U.S. tied for 36 medals at the top of the table. Norway has 29 and the United States has 12. So one country is outperforming expectations and it is not the United States.
The tone of some of these stories around the U.S. having a lousy Olympics is very like kind of catastrophe syndrome and like how horrible for American fans. You had a little bit of this in your piece, Ben, where you talked about Nathan Chan and Michaela Schifrin both, you know, not performing well at the same time and how that was a bad moment for American Olympics fans. I would push back on that a little bit because I feel like this is the rare sporting event where it's kind of all upside, at least for me as a viewer. Like, I get interested and I get happy if an American does well, especially if that American isn't Shaun White. But I just don't feel sad if the Americans don't perform well. Like, I don't know who these people are. I don't have that much time invested in them. And so I just feel like the notion that American Olympics fans are sitting at home waving flags and the flags are like drooping if the athletes don't well, that just doesn't really comport with my experience.
I was going to say the person who you just met 15 minutes ago who falls on the ice is not depressing you the way, you know, a lifelong fandom would. That's shocking. But the thing about that, and especially about that night when Nathan Chen and Michaela Schifrin both went down, is that I think it's set up the way we could have rooted for those people for at least another night and, you know, possibly even into the second week for Michaela Schifrin. And by we, I mean like Americans and not, you know, you or I specifically. But, you know, Nathan Chen fell in his short program. And if he goes into the long program the next night competing with Yuzuru Hanyu, like the great Japanese figure skater, that's another night of tension on television. If Michaela Schifrin wins gold in the slalom, suddenly she is chasing a historic medal haul. And all of those hopes coming down in the same night, I don't think was like a disastrous night for the United States. I think it was more just like, it could have been a very cool thing to watch these two young phenoms, you know, chase even greater goals going forward in the Olympics.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's obviously bad for NBC that they can't hype the next few nights of coverage around, are they going to set records or are they going to, you know, continue their amazing performances?
I think it's true. It was probably worse for NBC than it was for the United States in general.
But one could also imagine a coverage strategy in which NBC realizes that most people at home are coming into these games knowing very little about the athletes and watching less because they have distinct rooting interests in any individual athletes than because, oh, cool, here's another chance to watch these sports that we only watch once every 4 years, and instead sort of tune their coverage into emphasizing the event itself and what a great experience it is and how much fun and how exciting this is, even if the American falls in his short program or even if the American might not take the gold. And Josh, I know we wrote about this with the halfpipe competition. It was such a great event and Shaun White took gold, but Ayumu Hirano from Japan made it in really tight match all the way up to the end and almost won gold. And from watching NBC, you sort of got the impression that it would only have been a successful event for the network if Shaun White took gold. Watching at home, it felt to me like they were completely unprepared for the possibility that someone other than him would have taken gold. And that is just a matter of pre-event preparation.
Ben, I wanted to ask you about your stories on the Norwegians and how chill they are, and also about the U.S. Olympic Nordic combined team practicing in a refrigerated parking garage.
Also chilled, but in a very different way.
Is that why the American Olympic team is straggling in the medal table? Because all of their teams are practicing in various parking garages?
Yeah, and they're not chill enough. The reason Norway is sort of dominating this medal count, you know, there are a whole bunch of reasons, and that's sort of what we're planning a lot of coverage on for the last 5 days for Americans to learn how we can all be a little bit more Norwegian and dominate the Winter Olympics. But they have sort of taken the anti-American approach of not pressuring their athletes, not expecting certain results out of them, and just saying, we want you to be there to have fun and then worry about the medals second. And in fact, when some people in Norway tried to ratchet up the pressure on these Winter Olympians and winter sports there, I mean, cross country, biathlon, ski jumping. I mean, these are like basketball, baseball, and football in the United States. When certain, you know, television personalities try to ratchet up the heat, basically Norwegian has just said, no, we're not really interested in that. We, you know, are going to keep smiling. We're going to keep giving interviews and we'll see what happens. And what has happened is they're on pace to, I believe, win more medals than they ever have in the history of the Olympics, for them anyway. And it's sort of been a remarkable gold rush for them. And it's kind of interesting just to hear people talk about sports the way that they do in such a relaxed and chill, I think is the word we used, way. You don't really hear that in the United States, and especially, you know, around the United States Olympic teams. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see going forward if any of these teams sort of take a lesson from Norway.
I guess another way to talk about this or think about it is that for a lot of Americans who are participating in sports that aren't popular here, that don't get a lot of funding, you know, like in cross country, for example, there was, I believe the women's team finished fifth in the relay, and the women on that team were really happy. You know, that doesn't make it into the medal table. It doesn't get a lot of publicity here in the US, but that's like a major accomplishment. And it also just seems a little ridiculous for us to be disappointed when we don't give a shit about any of these sports, except for maybe like 5 minutes a year. So we need to recalibrate our expectations and be happy with fifth place. That's what I say.
It's so funny to get some of these press releases from the United States Olympic Committee and specific teams that are like celebrating an individual ski jumper finishing in 17th place, like an American record. And you're like, 17th place, like, I, you know, even silver and bronze, watching those people be so happy to get second and third place is so anathema to our sports culture. I mean, get second or third place in like the NBA and it's like a terrible season. And here you have like the Shibutanis winning bronze and it's the greatest day of their lives. And like, it's probably the best result they could have had. And they recognize that. It's just, it's a very funny place to go from the way we watch sports. Like you go from the Super Bowl to the Olympics. And if you're a ski jumper and you finish in 17th place, that's like the best you could have done. And you're actually happy with your result.
In a moment, we're going to talk about the shirtless Tongan flag bearer and the trickless Hungarian freestyle skier and other more exciting Olympic stuff with Ben and Justin. But before we get to that, I wanted to give a little preview of our Slate Plus segment today, and that we're going to talk to Ben about what it's been like to cover the games in South Korea, what his experience has been like having nothing to watch in the middle of the afternoon. And then we'll contrast that with our experience watching the games here at home in the United States. If you want to hear that, join Slate Plus for just $35 a year. And if you do, you can get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangupplus.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Over the weekend, the world discovered Elizabeth Marion Sweeney. She is a half-pipe skier, one of those freestyle skiers that does a lot of tricks coming out of the pipe. It's really dangerous. They do a lot of twists and spins and turns. She participated in the qualifying round for the half-pipe event, and here is how the announcers called it.
Liz Sweeney just getting up to the top of the wall, going for these grabs, the safety grab you'll see there, and then opting for another, just cruising up to the top of the wall, showing the judges she can make it down this half pipe clean.
So, Justin, we saw this clip around the same time, I think, that the rest of the world did, and we were just, like, didn't really understand what was going on or didn't know what to make of it. I mean, you couldn't really tell from hearing the announcers, but she wasn't trying to do any tricks. She wasn't like really emerging from the half pipe at all. She was just kind of having a leisurely meander up and down.
It was so odd and disingenuous the way that the commentators called her run, as if she were no different from any of the skiers who preceded her. And if you watched any of the event, you would have noticed that the skiers who preceded her were different from Sweeney insofar as they were actual freestyle halfpipe skiers who tried to do tricks at the top of the pipe, whereas this woman is just resolutely focused on making it to the top of the pipe, turning around and staying upright throughout. And you got these commentators, you know, just describing what she's doing as if they're actual point earning tricks, as opposed to the product of someone who has found a loophole in the system to game her way into the Olympics. And it was bizarre. The entire thing is just bizarre. It's funny, but bizarre.
So her scam to get in the Olympics, let's describe it. So she picked a sport where there aren't that many women that participate. She had previously tried to qualify for the Olympics in skeleton, representing Venezuela. She's American. This time she tried to get into the Olympics as a halfpipe skier representing Hungary, where supposedly her grandparents come from. So the way that she accrued the like points to get high enough in the World Cup standings to qualify automatically was she basically just spent a crap ton of money to go to every World Cup event, which is a thing that's prohibitively expensive, I think, for most athletes to do. She went to all these, and she, like, her strategy was to do exactly what she did in the Olympics, which was to just go up and down the pipe without falling down. And then occasionally there would be skiers who tried and they would fall and she would finish above them in the standings. And so she did that. She qualifies for the Olympics. And the thing that really confused me, and it confused Justin too, Ben, is like, okay, round of applause. You figured out how to scam your way into the Olympics by like pulling this like go to every event and not fall down scheme. But she like didn't manage to learn a single trick along the way. And it's not like if she does the same thing at the Olympics, like she's gonna earn points to like make it to some like super universe Olympics by not falling down. It's like, why not actually try to do something on the biggest stage? Like, that was the part to me that was kind of like, what is wrong with you? Rather than like, you know, you got to give you a pat on the back for figuring this out.
Have you ever tried riding up and down a half pipe?
You know what, Ben? I don't appreciate that question. I feel like if this was like my whole mission in life is to do this, and she's clearly been trying to do this for like years and years and years, I just don't understand what you get out of it if your goal is to get to the Olympics and you're just going to like pull shit like that.
You're putting years into this, a lot of money. You got to fly all around the world to these World Cup events. Like, learn a trick.
Let's just yell at Ben more. I've realized that it's hard. Like, obviously it's hard. It's the fucking Olympics. And like, if the people in the Olympics, like, really, I mean, this is an event, and we're going to get to PETA, the shirtless Tongan cross-country skier. Like, he didn't really know how to cross-country ski, like, all that well compared to the other folks in the Olympics. But, like, you can't really tell as a casual viewer. He's just going a lot slower. Like, he's moving along. He's, like, moving his arms and legs in the same fashion as whoever it is from Norway that's winning this race. But, like, this is a discipline and an event where if you don't know what you're doing, it's like painfully obvious to everyone. And so I just don't understand what's going on in her head that she did this.
Well, the other question is what she got out of it, right? I haven't seen anything where she has explained it all that well yet.
Well, Ben, she said after the event that she was disappointed that she didn't make it to the final.
Very disappointed.
And like, she's, I think, not delusional enough for that to be true. I think she's just being disingenuous, which is another reason why I find her annoying.
Well, she did run for governor of California when she was all of 19 years old, right?
She did.
She didn't make it on the ballot, but she did try. And side note, if you ever want to spend an interesting 20 minutes, go back and try to find the list of everyone who tried to get on that ballot but didn't. Travis Kalanick from Uber tried to get on. Dale Hewley, wow, the comedian, tried to get on. Jerry Brown tried to get on and failed. Very interesting stuff.
I agree. I think you might have been being sarcastic that that was interesting, but I agree. All right, Ben, I think the question here is, what is acceptable Olympics tourism and what is unacceptable Olympics tourism? And you've, this is like your wheelhouse. This is the question that I expect you to answer definitively for me and for the podcast listeners.
if you are an Olympian in a summer sport and over the course of the next year, teach yourself a winter sport, despite never having access to that winter sport, never having access to the surface where that winter sport takes place, and get at least decent enough to qualify even through the widest loopholes in the sport, I think that's acceptable Olympics tourism. And so that takes us to PETA, the shirtless Tongan flag bearer, whose story from Rio to Pyeongchang we've sort of chronicled somewhere between obsessively and excessively, somewhere right in the sweet spot there. And, you know, we went out to see him in South Korea as he actually competed last week. And there are easier ways to get to the Olympics than to teach yourself how to cross-country ski in the course of a year. I mean, as you guys were talking about, like, you have to at least do it. And, like, cross-country skiing is really hard. I was sort of out of breath just watching him. And that was not only...
He finished the race.
He finished the race, and he finished not in last place. I mean, the guy who finished in last place was his training buddy, Herman, who's a 43-year-old father who runs a specialty running store in McAllen, Texas, and was running the New York City Marathon in like 3 hours and 19 minutes 3 or 4 years ago. So that's who finished behind him. But he still had to do it, and he still had to train for a year and get himself in shape to finish a race without dying on his skis.
And dude is legit from Tonga. Like, this guy is actually from Tonga. He's not an American who's claiming Tongan grandparentage
after trying to claim Venezuelan grandparentage first. And you know, the nice thing about him is that he might be the most earnest person at the Olympics, and yet he also understands the absurdity of this quest. He's kind of irresistible. And, you know, it's just been like such a treat to be able to write about, you know, this guy who had never been on snow before trying to teach himself to cross-country ski because he loves the Olympics so much. And that's like, you know, the Olympics, there's so much nasty stuff about the Olympics these days, and so much of it is deserved. But you also see those moments here where, like, you know, Herman the Mexican, who runs a running store in Texas, like grabbing the Mexican flag as like his buddies from countries around the world are waiting for him at the finish line, when you kind of reminded that it is a pretty cool event when it all goes right.
Justin, I would say the very simple metric to decide whether somebody belongs in the Olympics as an Olympics tourist is, when other Olympians see you, do they want to take their picture with you?
Yeah. Or do they roll their eyes and say, what are you doing here? And the funniest thing about the trickless Hungarian skier is that everyone knows her on the World Cup circuit, but not in a good way. And I feel like this is one of the few stories I've read where Olympians have asked to be quoted off the record in describing their true feelings about Elizabeth Sweeney. And everyone wants to go on the record talking about the shirtless Tongan. He seems like a great guy who understands, as Ben said, like the absurdity of his quest. I mean, his quote about what his goal was, you know, well, you know, finish the race, don't ski into a tree. You know, compare that against Elizabeth Sweeney's apparently earnest confusion that she didn't make the finals. It's a tale of two cities. I know what city I want to live in.
We should give the shirtless Tongan the benefit of having his entire name read on this podcast. That'll be the real cherry on top of his Olympics experience. It's Pita Tafa Tafua.
And I like how we've sort of mimicked the style of shirtless Tongan flag bearer with trickless Hungarian skier.
Yes, I think that is to our credit. The best moment of the Olympics thus far for me was Esther Ledechka, the snowboarder, who, after NBC declared the race being over — this is the women's Super G, the top 20 women had already come down the hill, then they start, you know, the parade of kind of lower ranked skiers, and then she comes down 26th, and to like the great shock of everyone in attendance, she, you know, beats the time of Anna Veith, who was in first place.
Well, these are the Olympics, and anything can happen, and it just happened while everyone on this hill, everyone here in the media, including us, was anointing Anna Veith of Austria the winner in the women's Super G. Esther Ledecka came down the hill, Bodhi, just a short time ago and shocked the world.
It was one of these moments of surprise and delight in the Olympics. Ledechka, who's from the Czech Republic, she's obviously not an Olympics tourist, but she was participating in an event that was like her second best event. She's a favorite to win the gold in snowboarding later this week. Ben, did you kind of get a sense around Pyeongchang that people were just like totally like fascinated and mystified by this? Were people as like overwhelmed by it as they seem to be kind of around the world?
I think the European press, especially, that understands like what an insane thing this was. You know, I feel like for people who cover the sport day in and day out, they know that the people who go beyond like the top 20 skiers are not supposed to win the gold medal. And in fact, you know, I was at Mikaela Shiffrin's race the day before, and, you know, I actually never covered a ski race before. And, you know, I was trying to figure out what the order of the skiers was, like why the top people seemed to be going in the top 20 and who was going beyond it. And it obviously became clear that the people who were going after those people were the people who just had no shot of winning. And so, you know, to find out the next day that this person who, again, does another sport at the Olympics, I mean, that's like the craziest thing I've ever heard, to not only be good enough to medal in one sport, but in a completely different sport in the same Olympics medal,
It's not completely different. It's not like she's also playing hockey.
It's not like she's a cross-country skier turned taekwondo fighter, just saying.
I mean, it's just a different thing underneath her feet, man. Let's not go crazy. No, you're right. It's quite a feat. It's remarkable. Justin, what was your take on kind of the shit that NBC got for botching this? I felt that was like not in like the top 45 things that NBC has done wrong during the Olympics. Because as Ben said, it's like nobody around the like entire universe and people who are experts in this sport thought that she had any chance.
Here's my take. I don't blame NBC for cutting away from the race. Where I do find fault is in the way that they made it seem as if the race was actually over to people watching at home, which it wasn't. There were still more people to go. And all they had to say was, rather than say, Anna Veit wins gold, all you need to say is, well, it looks like she's got a firm grasp on the gold medal. There are still a few skiers to go, but it looks like she's got this one cinched up. But okay, you didn't say that. That's fine. Why didn't they cut back in a better, like, manner? Everything's on tape delay. You know, Deadspin wrote about that, and they made a great point. Everything is on tape delay, and I think the fact that they went back to it and had the NBC ski commentators call it as if they were calling an instant replay of something that had just happened is a function of what we were talking about before, the network's focus on American athletes and American accomplishment at the expense of giving a broader look at the excitement of the games.
All right, we're going to wrap up here, but I promised Nathan Chen in my intro, and I don't want to be made a liar. Ben, you wrote about him. You spent a bunch of time with him. His performance in the free skate was amazing, spectacular, like the most quad jumps ever. And if he hadn't flubbed the short program so badly, he would have won a medal. But what's your sense of him? He's 18. Like, what kind of guy is he? What's interesting about him?
So I went to a Golden State Warriors game with him, actually. 2 days after he won the U.S. championships, and he was probably the favorite at that point to win gold in the individual event. Han Yu from Japan was struggling with an injury. Uno hadn't really performed all that great this season, and Nathan Chen was coming on. And the interesting thing to me about him, in addition to the quads, and the reason I wanted to write about him, was that he's obsessed with the NBA, which, you know, probably shouldn't be all that surprising since he is 18 years old. And it seems like if you are 18 years old, you're probably more likely than not obsessed with the NBA. But if you had asked me how old he is, I would have said he's 25. He really carries himself much older than he is, which only made his short programs in the team event and the individual event even more shocking to me. I mean, he admitted afterwards, especially after he nailed the free skate, that he was jittery and he was nervous on that stage, which, you know, it's one of those things that as a non-athlete of any sort, I can't really understand. But just, you know, you step onto that Olympic ice and you really do feel it. And he seemed to do that. And I was, you know, I was talking about this with a bunch of people here, whether he would have had that free skate if he had, you know, been in contention in the short program. It's impossible to know. He probably wouldn't have attempted the six quads. He wouldn't have been as loose as he was. You know, if he had done just a little bit better on the short, who knows?
Justin, the really like kind of fascinating aspect of Michaela Schifrin's first week of the Olympics was that she won gold in her first event. As Ben said before, it was the giant slalom, not the one she was expected to win. And then she goes into her slalom where she's expected to win the gold. The like conventional narrative around that would be the pressure's off. She already has a gold medal. This is her best event. And NBC, and I thought this was like really good of NBC actually, they like had a reporter there saying like she just threw up. Like she seems like she's like kind of losing her shit here. And then, you know, she's been really open and honest about the fact that she's nervous and that she's scared, and like, good for her. Like, you know, be, you know, embrace that and like tell people that it's okay to be nervous. But I thought that was really fascinating about her and the fact that she's so dominant and had already won gold that she was still, you know, so nervous going into her big event.
I mean, it's nerve-wracking competing at the Olympics, I would assume.
Not if you're Elizabeth Swainy.
Well, no, not if you're her. No, but I mean, I was going to ask, like, Ben, like, it seemed to me that, you know, just from watching at home, that, you know, Nathan Chen may have been affected in his short program by having to immediately follow Han Yu, who, you know, skated such a great program. And then there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of, you know, stuffed Winnie the Pooh bears being flung onto the ice. And it took several hours, I'm exaggerating, for them to be all sort of like cleaned up. And then, you know, watching the reigning gold medalist do his thing and everyone love him, and like, all right, your time, get out there and make everyone forget him. As a non-elite athlete, that would have certainly gone to my head. And, you know, I can certainly understand why it may have conceivably gone to his.
Following Han Yu is one thing. Following him after having to skate the ice longer than you would after anyone else, because there are so many Winnie the Pooh stuffed bears on the ice that need to be cleared, is like another thing. I mean, it certainly didn't help him. How much it hurt him, I think, is impossible to know. But, you know, LeBron James never has to worry about, like, you know, Winnie the Pooh bears being thrown onto the court when he's attempting a free throw. So it was a completely remarkable thing to see in person, just Winnie the Pooh's being rained down on the ice to celebrate this Japanese figure skater. It was like one of those things you really only see at the Olympics, I think.
Ben Cohen writes about the Olympics for the Wall Street Journal. He also writes about other things, but he's been in South Korea for the past couple weeks writing amazing stuff. You should check out his stories in the journal. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And Justin Peters is writing about the Olympics for Slate. His stuff is also amazing. And I really enjoy working with Justin for these 2 weeks. And really, whenever we get to work together, Justin,
true.
Thank you.
Likewise.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
In the run-up to the 2017 NBA draft, University of Washington freshman Markelle Fultz was the consensus number one pick. Mike Schmitz of Draft Express called him a franchise lead guard, future all-star, and a player any organization can build around. ESPN's Chad Ford compared him to James Harden, writing, "He's the most complete player in the draft. There really isn't anything he doesn't do well. He can shoot, handle, pass, and defend. He also has great size, length, and sneaky athleticism for his position." Now, about 8 months after the Philadelphia 76ers took Fultz with that number one pick, he isn't playing, and it's not entirely clear why. Earlier in the season, Fultz was diagnosed with a shoulder injury. Now, in videos of 76ers practices, Fultz has an incredibly ugly hitch in his shot. Honestly, if you didn't know this guy was supposed to be one of the best players in the world, you'd think he maybe hadn't even ever shot a basketball before. Kyle Newbeck, who writes for PhillyVoice.com, has been trying to figure out what's going on with Markelle Fultz for the last 6 months. We'll link to his recent story on our show page. It is called, appropriately enough, What Has Really Been Going On with Markelle Fultz. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm good. I look forward to you solving this mystery for me. I've been fascinated by Fultz since the season started. I think a lot of people are. And in my intro, I gave people a sense of the hype around him going into the draft. That was back in June. So when did it start to look like something was amiss with him? And what were the first signs that something was going on with Fultz?
The first real signs came in late September when training camp started. Some of the assembled media got to watch some scrimmaging and late practice stuff at the end of a training camp practice. And he had the jacked up free throw look that I think many people have become familiar with since, because it's become a big meme almost on Twitter. But on the first day, it was just like, oh, maybe he's just messing around. We didn't really pay any mind to it. And then he comes back day two and does the same thing. And so then we're at the point where we had to press both Markelle and the team about it. And they gave some conflicting answers, which was the start of a lot of conflicting answers from all parties involved.
So had there been any indication before late September that Fultz had ever had an issue with shooting? I mean, if you just look at the percentages, he shot over 40% from three in college and was known as a good shooter going into the draft, right?
Right. And we had no indication that this was going to be a problem, even as late as mid to late July. He played in Utah and Las Vegas Summer League with the Sixers then. And while there was a noticeable alteration to his shot with him shooting it a little more in front of his face, he still was hitting the variety of shots, the type of shots that you saw him hit in college, and doing it smoothly and really well. So we were all taken aback that this could have happened in the span of what seemed to us from the outside as something that happened within like 2 months.
All right. So in your piece, you kind of go into your reporting a little bit, which is helpful as a reader. Like, you get the sense of like how difficult it was to acquire information from the team. You also were able to acquire information from sources outside the team. Can you just explain to folks what the process has been like for you to try to figure out what Fultz has been doing, kind of who's in his ear, and what the developments have been with this story?
With a story like this, you really just want to talk to everybody that's involved with it and everybody that's around the kid, because you have to go into—
And he's 19, so he
yes,
is a kid,
he
right?
is very much a kid. You go into something like this, and you know that everyone here is going to have an agenda. The team is incentivized to pump him up. He's the number one overall pick. They're going to tell you they believe in him. They're going to point the finger at outside influences or people that are outside the building. And conversely, the people that have been around Markelle his whole life are going to say, look, we've been around this kid since he was a child, and he was great the whole time he was with us. Now he's with your organization that's had a bit of a spotty track record with health issues, I guess we could say, the last few years. And now he's messed up and not shooting the right way. So really, it was an exploratory process more than anything. I will say, in the interest of transparency, some of it was just getting random tips from different people. I talked to lots of Sixers fans, people in the Philadelphia area who are heavily invested in all this. And they would say, hey, he's at this gym, but it's going through that legwork, that process of reporting. It was fun, but it's also depressing at the same time, because this kid is obviously going through some serious problems here.
So the fundamental question here seems to be, does Fultz have a shoulder injury? Or did he perhaps have a shoulder injury in the past, and then because of, you know, trying to compensate for it, his shot got screwed up and he hasn't been able to get it back? Or is he having whatever the basketball equivalent is of, like, you know, Rick Ankiel being unable to throw a pitch, you know, and hit the strike zone? I guess I want to, like, just state up front my view, and I feel like this is how most people should think about it, if not everyone, is, like, if he is having a psychological issue, that's, like, no less real than if he's having a shoulder issue, and it should be treated, I think, or thought about or talked about in a similar way. And so I'm just curious what your conclusion was, or what you believe after talking to all these people. Do you think that the shoulder injury was real at one point, or is real now?
So I think that there's a combination of factors at play here. I think that the first problem is that he and his personal trainer, a guy named Keith Williams, who's been working with him for a long time, they tinkered with the shot mechanics too close to the season. Something obviously went wrong prior to him showing up to training camp, and that was sort of the catalyst for all this. Now, what happens from there is, I guess you could say, it's up for debate. I wouldn't say that he was never injured, or at least never dealt with any soreness. I think the doctors who have seen him would not put their reputations on the line making up an injury for this kid. But at the same time, when the Sixers were saying in late October, early November, that he's out indefinitely, I had multiple people tell me he's still shooting jump shots in private. And just because he's not on public display for the cameras doesn't mean he's not still currently working through this issue. Like, to me, the biggest tell was there was a report in late October where his agent came out and said he can't lift his arm up above his head, which, that's a pretty huge claim for a professional athlete. Well, I talked to several people that day who said on that very day when the agent said he can't lift his arm up, he was shooting hundreds of jumpers in the Sixers practice facility. So at the very least, you're being, I guess, misled or lied to about the severity of what was happening. And then on top of all this, there's, even if there wasn't a mental aspect to it in the beginning, I think there's very clearly a mental block or a mental aspect to this now. And really, that's no different than a lot of guys who have an injury or have some sort of problem where they're trying to become the same person or player they were before, and now they can't get it back. So I think, like, Josh, if you forgot how to talk for this podcast, do you think there would be a mental block eventually? That's the equivalent of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think that's a fair analogy. I think people might be happy, some people, if I forgot to talk and couldn't do this podcast. But a lot of Sixers fans are sad that they can't see Fultz on the court. I guess the question that I have is, how do you feel like the Sixers organization has handled this? I mean, this has been, for better or worse, a franchise that has had a lot of experience with number one picks, you know, not playing their first seasons with Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. So I guess that could cut either way. But just seeing these, like, videos from the practice facility where it seems like they're being taken from, like, you know, 100 yards away or something, and you just, it's kind of crazy, zoom in and see him, like, botching free throws or whatever. Is the team to blame for those videos getting out? Is the team to blame? I mean, obviously the team isn't to blame for the agent seemingly lying about what his condition was, but, like, where do you fall on, like, how the Sixers have handled it overall?
So I think they certainly deserve some blame. I think internally their objective has been to empower Markel whenever they get the chance. So part of the reason that he's out in front of the cameras and becoming, I guess, a living meme is that Markel feels like he should be out there, that he wants to just be, I'm a normal basketball player, this is what I do, and I'll live and die with the results. And
so he's cool with those videos being out in the world.
I don't know that I would say he's cool with the videos being out there, but there is a part of this process is of him returning to play is getting him readjusted to like, look, dude, you're going to be under a certain level of scrutiny for pretty much the rest of your career. I mean, when you start your career with something like this, there's going to be a mistrust between you and the public on some level. So I think the Sixers, because he feels this way, because he loves basketball so much, they want him to just feel as normal as possible. Now, that being said, when you see your player being scrutinized to this degree and every single shot that he takes turned into a viral video, at a certain point, I think you have to say, look, we're just going to keep him behind closed doors. When he's ready, he's ready. Because if there is a big mental issue, which I don't want to speculate on stuff like that, I don't think any of this can be helping. I mean, look, you and I are sitting here talking, having a whole podcast segment about him. There's been countless articles, countless videos posted. None of this can be good for him.
Yeah, I mean, it seems just kind of unavoidable,
yeah,
the scrutiny, although I do think the team could manage it and manage him better. I guess like what you're saying, if they're following his wishes at a certain point, it's really up to him and there's only so much the team can do. I guess my question is, and one of the things that was most interesting in the piece was it just seems like everyone really likes each other. Like he seems to like the team and his teammates seem to like him. It doesn't really seem like we're at the recrimination stage yet. I guess the question is that accurate? And do you see this kind of like going south, or do you feel like everyone at this point is still like kind of on the same page and just feels like we're going to work through this together?
From every indication I've been given, I think they will eventually work through this. And his teammates, his coaches, people who are around the team all talk about how hard he works, how driven he is to get back. So I don't think there's the usual concern you might have with a player who's faltering in year one, where there have been plenty of guys who have busted due to a lack of drive, a lack of work ethic. They got to a certain point just because they were naturally gifted. I don't think that's the case with Markel, that everybody tends to rave about his character. But it's just, I don't know that there's a good answer here for the path forward. I think to the previous question about having him out on display, when they had him in private in November and December, they very much thought he was going to come back in early January because he looked so good in those private settings. And then once he was unleashed into this public format where he's under scrutiny again, that's when things started to go wrong. And I guess you could say he even regressed during that time. So I don't know what they can do more than they have been doing right now. I mean, this is an all hands on deck situation. The head coach, Brett Brown, is giving a lot of the instruction to Markel directly, which is hard for him to do given the fact that he has to coach the team night after night after night. But
that would usually go to like a skills development coach or like some assistant who is way down the bench, right?
Right. They specifically have a shooting coach named John Townsend. The person that most people see Markel work with is Billy Lang, who's an assistant coach who specifically does skills and development, but he has other responsibilities too. So they've turned to outside trainers. They've sent him to former NBA player Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who most people know as formerly as Chris Jackson at LSU. They've tried everything they possibly can just to make this kid feel loved and appreciated and nurtured and like you're a big part of our program. So I think they believe there's a path forward, but it's really hard to say.
I guess it's obvious to say this, but it just seems like they don't really know what to do, because nobody would know what to do in this situation, because it's just not something that's really been seen or dealt with before on the NBA level, at least as far as I'm aware of. There is a little bit of a history of it in baseball, and you're being very responsible and not wanting to speculate about whether it is a psychological issue. But I just think it's clear that the Sixers don't know what they're doing. And I think it's clear that nobody else would necessarily know what they were doing. And I think it's clear that none of us sitting here know what's going to happen. And it just, it must be like kind of scary for him just to lose this kind of fundamental ability. And I just really hope for him, because by all accounts, he seems like a good dude. He's working really hard, that he's able to recapture it. And I'm just curious what Philly fans, I mean, I'm sure that given the Super Bowl win, they're just going to be like super duper chill for the next like decade about everything. But I'm just wondering if like what the kind of like baseline Philly fan thinks and has to say about Fultz and what's going on with him.
It's sort of all over the place. I think honestly, there are a lot of people who, some of the diehards get mad when people like me and several other of my colleagues even report on this stuff. They think that what we're doing is damaging to Markelle by putting all this out there. And I think I've tried
to. If nobody talks about him, then he'll get better. Right. It's like some magical thinking.
I do get it on some level, and I have tried to be responsible in what I say and don't say, because we said it at the beginning of our segment here. He is a 19-year-old kid, and regardless of what the cause of all this is, he's dealing with something that's really tough, that what he loves to do has been taken away from him in a sense. And so I do sympathize with him, but we can't craft our jobs around something being hard to the subjects we cover. And so that's been a big part of the fan response. There's a lot of sympathy for him. There's been plenty of people who want to write him off as a bust already, which to me is crazy. He's only played 4 professional games. And if anyone judged me on the first 4 articles I ever wrote professionally, I probably would never work again. So I would say, even though I'm supposed to be objective reporter guy here, I think I'm rooting for him just to return to form, just out of sympathy for him and the situation.
Kyle Newbeck writes for Philly Voice. His story is called "What Has Really Been Going On with Markelle Fultz." Kyle, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Josh.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for Afterballs, and it's just me, your pal Josh, here by myself doing an Afterball. But I'm still going to go through the typical Afterball procedure. I'm going to pick an Afterball name. And I was thinking while watching the ice dancing on Monday night, that Tessa Virtue of the gold medal winning ice dance team of Virtue and Moyer, that Tessa Virtue is just obviously a fake name, and that I thought that I would pick a couple other, you know, fake names for her to go by in future Olympics if she wants to retire Tessa Virtue. I was thinking maybe Maybelline Justice would be a good name for Tessa Virtue. Also, I like Sienna Humanity. And then my final one was Vivica Pulchritude. I thought Vivica Pulchritude had a really good ring to it. So I'm going to go with that for my Afterball name. And I'm going to pair the Afterball name of Vivica Pulchritude, which is ridiculous, I think I can fairly say, with an extremely serious Afterball. So I'm going to give you a little sweet and sour Afterball cocktail here. The subject of this Vivica Pulchritude is that Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr, as is his wont, made a very strong public statement last week after the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
It doesn't seem to matter to our government that children are being shot to death day after day in schools. It doesn't matter that people are being shot at a concert, in a movie theater. It's not enough, apparently, to move our leadership, our government, the people who are running this country, to actually do anything. And that's demoralizing. But we can do something about it. We can vote people in who actually have the courage to protect people's lives and not just bow down to the NRA because they've financed their campaign for them.
So as you might be aware, Steve Kerr got his social conscience, or credits getting his social conscience, to his family background. His father, Malcolm Kerr, was the president of the American University of Beirut, and he took that job in 1982, despite the fact that Lebanon was in the middle of a civil war. In January 1984, the 52-year-old Malcolm Kerr was assassinated by unidentified gunmen. The New York Times wrote that he was killed not for being who he was, but because now that the Marines and the American embassy in Beirut are smothered in security, he was the most vulnerable prominent American in Lebanon and a choice target for militants trying to intimidate Americans into leaving. Steve Kerr was a freshman at the University of Arizona when his father was killed, and he was famously taunted by Arizona State students with the chants PLO, PLO, and your father's history, and why don't you join the Marines and go back to Beirut? Kerr has rarely spoken about his father, but he did say in an interview in 2015, "I feel his full impact on my whole life. It's there every day." After the Trump administration's immigration ban went through in January 2017, he talked about his father again. Here's a clip of that.
Someone who is, whose family member was a victim of terrorism, and having lost my father, if we're trying to combat terrorism by banishing people from coming to this country, by really going against the principles of what our country's about and creating fear, it's the wrong way to go about it. If anything, we could be breeding anger and terror.
What I didn't realize until doing a little bit more background reading this weekend, though, is that the Kerr family's legacy in the Middle East goes back a generation further. As the New York Times' John Branch wrote in December 2016, Malcolm Kerr's parents, Stanley and Elsa Kerr, were American missionaries who met in the Middle East after World War I. He worked for American Near East Relief in Turkey during the slaughter of countless Armenians, and Stanley Kerr, Steve Kerr's grandfather, wrote a book about that experience. It was called The Lions of Marash. And as John O. Boghossian wrote for UpRocks, this was a piece also in 2016, Near East Relief is credited with helping preserve the Armenians in the face of the genocide that sought to destroy them. They pioneered the idea that all Americans, regardless of age, income, or background, could help others. Now, that's a family legacy that Steve Kerr is carrying on to this day. He is one of many NBA coaches, players who speak out on social issues. But the thing I really wanted to get back around to at the end of this afterball was that it was absolutely disgraceful that Kerr let his players coach themselves against the Phoenix Suns the other day. Have you no decency, sir? Have you no respect for the game? Shame on you, Steve Kerr, a guy who should probably, at the very least, be vice president to Greg Popovich. Steve Kerr, good dude. That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort, and filling in for Patrick this week was Andrew Parsons. Our intern is Jason Rosenzweig. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. You should also check out If Then, a podcast about technology, society, and power. Each week, Slate's April Glazer and Will Arimas take you on a lively tour of the tech news that actually matters, from fake news in your Facebook feed to the algorithms that want your job, to the Uber drivers who want a job with benefits. With news-making interviews of key tech industry figures, fascinating academics, and top tech journalists, they explore not only how the technology that's shaping our world works, but the ideas, ideologies, incentives, and biases that underlie it. And guess what? They do not always agree. Go to slate.com/ifthen to get a new episode every Wednesday. I am Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.